And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Vertel. And there's no one else here. It's just us.
Well, you know, it's our last episode of the year, so I figured we would give people just a Louis and Ira moment.
A little peace and quiet for once. My God, all these extras running around yammering. Also, I am realizing something is up with my throat. So if I sound a little bit more Lauren Bacall than usual, I apologize. Or you're welcome.
No, I actually had a cold this weekend too. So, the past 2 days. So I think that my throat is getting over it. Been sucking too much dick like Nancy Reagan.
Oh my God. I think we'll get into that, but what a pleasing turn of events on social media. Rarely does it work out that much for everybody involved. to learn about Nancy's early Hollywood extracurriculars on a mass scale. I mean, it was literally an education in old Hollywood for the entire internet. And we don't get that luxury.
Well, I think I love it mostly because it started out from, what was it? Ben Shapiro or Tucker Carlson's
sister,
trying to do a tweet to slut shame Madonna randomly for no reason. It's just like a random photo of Madonna. And then people started dragging Nancy Reagan. So
yeah, the tweet was, why look like this when you could look like this, basically? And she used a picture of Madonna on Instagram, which, can you believe it? She's in like a leotard and with her Ava Max hair, you know, like sprawled out on a bed. And she compared it next to Nancy Reagan at the same age, you know, looking like fucking Nancy Reagan, smiling through the AIDS crisis. And the internet responded with, you're calling Madonna trashy. Well, Nancy was the blowjob queen of Hollywood. And then referred to a passage, and I believe is her name Kitty Kelly, the biographer's one of her many books about old Hollywood. And so Nancy, pole licker.
It's just a reminder that you should not mess with Madonna fans. They mostly are dormant. They're mostly dormant. And it was, I think someone had mentioned that if you didn't use that to compare them to her to Lady Gaga, Madonna fans are used to that, so they would have ignored it. It would have been perfectly innocuous, but they were activated.
Right. And also the angle, of course, you could take is, well, let's talk about how they both responded to AIDS in the 80s, and Madonna, you know, famously one of the outspoken about AIDS in the 80s, and, you know, the Reagans less so, rather famously. So we got to reference that angle too. Yeah, as a Madonna fan, we've just been through it. I mean, we're rightfully shamed for certain things she has done, and so we've taken that hit several times. But you bring in someone like Nancy Reagan into the picture, and, you know, the borderline girls come out. Mm-hmm. Borderline in personality, perhaps.
Plus, Nancy's version of Evita sucked. So,
oh God, yeah, and her version of Bloodhounds of Broadway, shitty. That's a Madonna movie no one talks about. She has a duet with Jennifer Grey.
Last night, she dreamt of Rock Hudson dying. That's her version of La Isla Bonita. Anyway, this week we're going to get into our favorite performances of the year,
which, by the way, can be in any medium. I have chosen movies and TV, but music videos, that's available. Commercials, which some people still watch.
You got a commercial to talk about?
No. The last one I can think of is Carly Kloss talking about Wix, where Wix.com is over her shoulder. And she's like, there it is, Wix.com, pointing at it. Like, that's how you interact with the internet.
I actually think I do have a commercial.
Oh, really?
Which one? Yeah. Well, we got to wait.
Oh, wow. I'm being baited. Okay, great.
And then we'll get into the thing that everyone on the internet is talking about. And just like that.
Woof. I mean, actually, you know what? I didn't. We'll get into it. We'll get it. I'm excited.
Plus, we'll be joined by Thomas Doherty from the new Gossip Girl reboot.
And we can talk about how this bastard looks so much like Frank Sinatra sometimes. It's weird.
Mm. Ronan Farrow better watch out. Someone's getting that inheritance.
He better watch out, period, because that bastard threw a party over the weekend and I fell off the guest list this year and it's on my mind. So let's figure that out.
I picked another birthday party over Ronan's. Anyway, sorry, Ronan. We'll be back with more Keep It. And just like that, I did not realize that we were going to hear the phrase "and just like that" so many fucking times in this show.
I kind of had forgotten that it was the name of the show, that it is referenced in all the materials. So I should have known that it would be a motif on the show. That said, it's one of those phrases where it's like all unimportant words. So I kind of would keep forgetting what the actual phrase is. There are movies like that from time to time where they're titled a certain way and you're like, I can't remember what the actual phrasing is because they chose a bunch of stupid words.
And needless to say, there will be spoilers in this discussion of And Just Like That, the Sex and the City sequel series that just dropped on HBO last week. And the phrase really took me out of it at the end of the first episode when, shocker, Big died. Because...
After a very famous Peloton ride, arguably the most famous Peloton ride of all time. Sorry, Cody Rigsby. It's all about Big now.
The phrase made me crack up during what was supposed to be a very emotional moment where Carrie is cradling Big on the bathroom floor because he's just had a heart attack. He's dying. And then you hear the voiceover, and just like that, Big died. Yeah.
As if that's how you would talk about your husband dying. And just like that, he's gone. Also, the way she is cradling him in that particular moment, there's already been a ton of talk on the internet about this, but she runs home from the stupidest recital that one of Charlotte's kids puts on, where she is playing piano like, I mean, it's like Liberace level, the theatrics at this concert. Anyway, Carrie gets home, sees Big on the floor mid-heart attack, cradles him, doesn't call 911. People are wondering, why didn't she call 911 immediately? Well, I'll tell you why. Because when she's sitting there holding Big, it looks like one of the Stations of the Cross. I thought I was looking at a stained glass window in a Catholic church.
You know, HBO shows love their, they love their staging, okay? That's the best part of Succession.
Excuse me, the entire weekend, or pardon me, since that episode aired of Succession, is people pointing out stills of Succession being like, throw this in the Louvre. Guys, shut up. I know you like Succession. Stop pretending it's a fucking masterwork in terms of every still is like a stained glass window in a Catholic church.
Resident Catholic Louis Vertel is angry. Is angry, angry at the Catholic appropriation.
Franciscan nun Louis Vertel has risen from his convent.
Anyway, getting back into this series, I don't think I like it.
Thank you for that complex analysis. Well, can I tell you something? I would argue that I don't think there is a funny moment in the first two episodes, which is what's out right now. And as I just read and as I suspected, what we're watching was what the third movie was supposed to be. Like, you know, Big dying, Carrie moving on from it. And obviously no Samantha with no Kim Cattrall there. I actually forgive how bad it can be because I think the actresses remain amazing.
Yeah, I think they're really fucking great still after all these years. And I will say that the one part that was funny to me was Charlotte sobbing so much at the beginning of the second episode while they were looking at funeral homes because she blamed herself for Big's death, and then the funeral home director thinking that she was Big's wife and not Carrie because Carrie was so stoic. But I get, you know, the like wanting Carrie to move on and like having to have Big die to sort of like usher her into a new phase of her life, but it's just so weird in the sense that what now are, like, are we gonna jump ahead in the next episode because like we're gonna have to watch her try and date again and be easy breezy while also dealing with the love of her life's death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I will say in the first Sex and the City movie, which is when she and Big break up mid-wedding or whatever happens, and that was mostly a serious movie. Like, eventually, you know, they go through that entire winter and she dyes her hair brown and stuff. I kind of liked foregoing the comedy a little bit because there's something about the four of them being able to get into really being there for each other and not having to, like, pop off about, you know, the weird thing a guy did in bed or whatever the conceit of the show was initially. That felt a little deeper and more like real friends to me. That said, you're right. I'm a little worried about where this show is going, especially since they're kind of like making fun of the characters in a way that feels very Twitter in the past decade. Like Miranda all of a sudden is babbling at a black colleague about her, like, in a white savior type way that would be apparent to anybody paying attention even for 2 seconds. It felt very overwritten to me. Also, not to say that Miranda wouldn't be like that in real life, but it felt like people who watched the original Sex and the City and are afraid of blowback about the show not being aware of white women having privilege or something. It felt very shoehorned into the original recipe, Sex and the City.
All these black women popping up in the show feels a little random. And I also want to point out that they did my sis, Nicole Ari Parker, dirty. Because what black woman is walking up to a table in a restaurant and taking fries off of these white women's table and eating it? And also, that scene is so unhinged too, because it felt like a throwback to like the first season of Sex and the City with Carrie being like, "Ooh, I'm not going to tell if I ordered the fries or not. It's fucking French fries."
Yeah, right. Also, another thing about Carrie that is bothering me, so she's, of course, a podcaster on this version. Jesus. You know, worst possible timeline, you know, whatever. And on the podcast, the two other personalities on it are way more, like, outspoken and making, like, sexual jokes, like they're comedians. And then Carrie is sitting there basically cringing at their honesty. And it's like, there's no way Carrie wrote a column about sex for years and years and she's not heard things like this before. They made it seem like Carrie was brand new to the idea of kind of being bawdy in talking about sex. And her entire pun universe is based on bawdiness. So that didn't really flow to me.
Like, she wouldn't have heard any of that from Samantha.
Her best friend. Yes, right.
At 8 in the morning over an omelet.
Yeah.
And also, she wasn't just a sex columnist. She was a sex columnist in the 90s.
Right. So it's Eve Ensler times. So we're straight up using the word vagina and every other iteration thereof left and right.
So yeah, I wasn't a fan of any of the podcasting stuff. Sarah Ramirez's character is fucking weird. Like... the puffing marijuana in the elevator. It's so wacky.
Yeah. Yeah, she's giving you, Bugs Bunny, what's up, Doc? Yeah.
And it all just feels weirdly unnatural because I feel like she probably would have already had a podcast.
Yeah, uh-huh.
At this point, like, the newspaper or wherever she works at, like, someone would have urged Carrie to be doing a podcast already. And she seems so uncomfortable doing it. And it also seems like a radio show and not an actual podcast.
Correct, yes. And in fact, if she had just a radio show, that would sort of be fitting with Carrie being slightly stuck in the past. I want to say that, I mean, during these, like, devastating scenes, like her recovering from Big's death and stuff, again, SJP so brings it as an actress. And if you watch that show Divorce she did, you got a lot of sullenness there. But I truly think she is better here than she was there. Obviously, that show was very strange and tonally jumped from one extreme to another from week to week. Remember when Molly Shannon was on that? Weird casting choice.
To get into the other elephant in the room, so to speak, or the elephant who isn't in the room, The explanation for Samantha being gone is, okay, I get, like, Kim Cattrall isn't back, so you have to find a way to write her out, and you don't want to kill her. But goddamn, Carrie drops her as a client, and Samantha stops talking to them all and moves to London. Like, am I supposed to believe, like, Carrie was paying this bitch's bills?
Right. Samantha being clearly financially independent and also, like, always separating the personal from the professional on the show. Like, she would never, I think, mix those two things up. That said, we had heard initially that they had just kind of drifted apart, and I found that really believable, that, you know, Samantha's life would just take her in one direction. They could have gone that way, but they specifically wanted to mourn the end of their friendship on the show, like, as it, to make us all aware that she's not there. So I would give it like a B minus in terms of a possible explanation. Also, I really wonder if Kim Cattrall will end up back on the show, because if she does, I mean, that would be like the moment of the century, and HBO Max would, you know, have a reason to be.
Yeah. Which also, I can never tell if any show is on HBO or HBO Max.
No, right. They're all the same to me as I'm a millennial, and I love it that way.
Yeah, except there are shows that are specifically HBO Max shows and not HBO ones. And I guess the difference is the HBO ones still air on cable, but who has that anymore?
No, I don't know how to turn it on. Please. That TV is for Wheel of Fortune alone, okay? I'm not looking for anything else.
With that said, I feel like I just don't have an idea what the show is going to be about. You know? I get it in terms of, like, Carrie, perhaps. And Miranda, sure.
Miranda is apparently an alcoholic, which is a strange turn of events,
which I do not like, because I also would have had to drink a bottle of wine at a children's recital like that.
Right. Well, maybe it's telling us that alcoholism is good and that we should all be doing it.
but I'm also hard pressed to remember anything involving Charlotte's actual story in the past two episodes.
She reacts to Big's death with like a line of loud selfishness, and then also shows up at Carrie's place, and Carrie didn't invite her to hang out that particular day with Stanford and Miranda because Charlotte is too emotional. But on the show before this, on the actual HBO series, Carrie never would have done that to Charlotte. So I don't know where this is coming from either. Again, I'm happy for these characters to evolve, but some of the choices they made for these characters feel so outsized and immature that it sort of feels like you don't really know them anymore, or you're just watching all of the Twitter comments about these characters over the years being reacted to. You know, it doesn't feel like it's the creator's vision anymore. It feels like we're reacting to a reaction to these characters.
Yeah, you know, it feels like, I would say that's probably my biggest critique of the show. It feels like it is a response to the response to Sex and the City rather than a continuation, rather than Michael Patrick King had a, you know, like a long Bible for the series. And like, these are stories that he really wanted to tell from the past. You know, it doesn't feel like the staff too are like people who are continuing these stories. And it, in a way, it reminds me of the really bad X-Files reboot.
Which I forgot we got.
Yeah. Because that show, couple like really good episodes, but it was all the original writers. And that one was different in the sense that it didn't feel like a response to the response to the X-Files. Because one, it felt like white male writers from the 90s like still writing some of the uncomfortable stories that were running before. Like, I remember there was an awful episode like where Shangela like played like a trans character, and there were like awful tropes and like the way that they discussed like trans people on the show that just felt like old writers who didn't know what they were talking about. But it's the thing of seeing Mulder and Scully again in sort of like similar situations and imagining how they'd evolved and like seeing how they interacted, it just didn't feel real. But maybe we'll find out in 20 years that we're still acting exactly the same.
There is a feeling about this show of the unreal. Like, it's not settled. Like, we're all not sure really why we're doing this, but we are continuing on. Also, I just want to say, again, some of the outfit choices, which are now legendary at this point because bloggers blogged, you know, all this. I mean, like, Carrie at some point looks like a Native American countess. Just some of the choices are so extreme. And I know people have a memory of the show as having wild fashion, but honestly, it was all of that moment, generally speaking. The choices here are not, particularly for Carrie.
Yeah, and Miranda just looks like a librarian.
Correct. Which I think they're like leaning into in a way. There's a whole scene about how she goes gray and then Charlotte doesn't want to go gray. And actually, that's one of my favorite lines in the whole thing when Charlotte says, you don't mind that I'm... She makes a comment that Charlotte is offended that Miranda goes gray because it makes Charlotte look old, which I thought was a cool take.
And just like that, I think this conversation's come to an end.
And also, I hate like how much TV review depends on just the first couple episodes. Again, maybe it'll like springboard into something even more fabulous or something. I will stay abreast of this situation and follow my social media to stay updated on my takes.
All right, Lewis.
Lewis Fertel, girl reporter.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll discuss the rest of the episodes when we return to Keep It next year.
Oh, this is our last episode. By that time, Steve, Miranda's husband, will be the president or something.
And I'm still wondering what they're going to do with... I'm still wondering what they're going to do with Stanford.
Oh, right. Who we see in the first episode. Also, Mario Cantone, very funny. Enjoyed him on this. I wonder how they'll... There's going to be a lot of death this season.
Because I thought the funeral was going to be Stanford's.
Oh, I see.
I could see something bad happening with the way that, you know, the piano was being, you know, so like feverishly played. Something bad's going to happen. And then I was like, well, Stanford in real life, he passed away. So that's mm-hmm. what I was expecting. So I was shocked that Big died. But yeah, we'll see where this goes.
The feverish piano playing. If you've not seen the movie The Great Lie with Bette Davis and Mary Astor, that's what it reminded me of. And it feels like you suddenly have tripped into a wild 1940s movie. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, you know that I famously have said on this show that I hate things involving pianos.
Well, oh, that's right. Including the film The Piano, which is, you know, about one.
Yeah. Is it?
I mean, she plays the piano in it. There's a whole... She doesn't do much talking, so she's very expressive with the piano anyway.
Well, I'll never know. When we're back, we're joined by Thomas Doherty from Gossip Girl, another reboot on HBO Max.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preddy was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really... feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Our guest today has played Captain Hook's son and Helen Mirren's lover, but he's best known as one of the stars of the rebooted Gossip Girl. Please welcome Thomas Doherty. I guess you're best known as a person who I'm friends with, more so than I think about you being in Gossip Girl, but you are in that too.
I am indeed. Thank you guys for having me on. This is very exciting. Yeah, I wrote.
Actually, you know what? I thought I was going to bring this up later, but we're going to talk about this now. Playing Helen Mirren's lover. I mean, first of all, Helen Mirren is puzzling me right now because she's about to host a Harry Potter trivia show that's on television. She just will pick the most random things. But I want to know how she is as a person to work with. I assume she's rad and funny.
I mean,
but I don't know.
Go where the work is, you know, especially these times. Helen Mirren is so chill. She's so cool. I mean, I was obviously very nervous to work with a dame. And she's such an amazing actor. But she was so chill. I mean, like, I never really got to speak to her until we were in bed doing a scene. And we were both just lying there for a couple hours. And yeah, she was just chatting away, and she's super, super humble, very chill, really generous with like her energy and our advice and stuff. So yeah, it was fun.
It's interesting that you were intimidated by her, because I think among dames, she might be the least intimidating. So, but if I were to act with her, I would probably be
among
a little
dames.
Scared. But I'm just saying, like, you know, if I ran into whomever, Joan Plowright, I'm like, woof, you know, she's got some stories about Olivia. Or whomever, like most other, is Glenda Jackson a dame? Those people are scary.
I can't recall dames off the top of my head.
I was going to say, I mean, I can't, I'm trying to think of other ones. Who's
like Judi Dench?
Judi Dench,
that'd be scary.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, Judi Dench would be scary. Can you be a dame if you're not British?
I think there are occasions it's occurred, but it's rare.
I think Sean Connery was a dame.
Ira, you could be the next dame.
I think you might be wrong.
I would actually love that sort of like journey for me, but I don't think people want to hear me. I don't think people want to hear that accent. Not for me.
Yeah.
Imagine doing that in front of Maggie Smith.
It's just the accent that's in your way of becoming a dame.
Anyway, I feel like playing your lover in a film is actually like one of the least wildest things that Helen Mirren has done, because Lewis, you know, she's been in like 3 Fast and the Furious movies at this point.
Oh, true.
So anyway.
She was in the Fast and Furious movies. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you should watch them.
I mean, go where the work is.
So let's get into Gossip Girl now. Had you seen the original Gossip Girl when you did this show?
So it was a weird one. I think I was a lot younger when it came out, and in Scotland I wasn't aware that it was a thing until maybe I was about 20. And it wasn't, I was filming in Georgia when I was about 25 in 2019, and my girlfriend at the time started watching it probably for the 19th time. And she'd come to like visit me, and she'd have it on. And then when she'd leave, I'd keep watching it. And then maybe a couple months later, I found out that I had this for this new Gossip Girl. So, I mean, don't know if you're into manifestation or whatever, but I mean, it's pretty airtight to me.
No, I'm very much into manifestation, as Lewis knows. I talk about Brené Brown on this podcast all the time.
Oh, no, you don't. Because guess what I would do? Not be here. But
you manifested this, and now you're on it. And now it's weirdly almost, it's not as big, I think, as like the original one, in the sense that, like, you know, or is it? Are people like stalking you on the street, taking photos of you the way that I feel like they used to do with the original cast? Or is it just people sending in like tips of where they've seen you to Dumois?
Oh yeah, Dumois. Jesus, keeps me up at night. No, I think, yeah, I mean, I think it is very different. It's not as big I mean, it's always going to be hard when you're doing a reboot or a continuation of something so culturally iconic. But I think as well, the use of a better word, the climate at the time of media, it wasn't so saturated. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there was Netflix and all these streamers. So, I mean, when it came out on CW, it was very much a case of Thursday night or whatever, Gossip Girl's on, and then you watch it, and then you go into school the next day and talk about it with all your friends and all the rest of it. Nowadays, you can't, that's not really a thing. And like I say, because it's so saturated, it's a lot harder to stick out and a lot harder to last, have that lasting effect, because people's attention span is just so quick now. So yeah, it definitely doesn't have that same impact as the original did. But that's not to say that it's not as good, as I'm sure you guys will agree. I mean, it's very, very different. And again, the climate of the world, society, is entirely different. And I think it's definitely, it's a lot more conscious than the original one. And it's definitely taken an opportunity to show a lot more, many different kind of sections of society, and represent a load more people, which I really love and really enjoy.
Do you have a favorite way in which the show departs from what the original was? Because when I watched the new Gossip Girl, I'm like, I guess actually thrilled that it doesn't remind me of the original in many key ways, because I also don't want to see that show again. Like, I think if I were watching something that reminded me exactly of what I had seen before, I would be like, why am I doing this? I remember the original just fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was amazing. I really, really enjoyed that Josh Safran kind of, he kept the Gossip Girl. Obviously, I mean, it's kind of hard to do, because you don't want, like you say, you don't want it to be the original. You don't want it to just be a carbon copy. But at the same time, you have to stay true to it in some regard. So by making the teacher's Gossip Girl, I know people aren't great fans of it, but I thought that was a really, really clever idea, and I really enjoy that. And
it's
like
a smart idea, but they are demented.
it's kind of weird. I mean, you have these like 30-year-olds spying on kids and ruining their lives.
Which is what we do every week on this podcast. So actually, it's similar. Yeah. This is the most relatable show on TV.
No, I said 30-year-olds.
Oh, this bitch. Oh, my God.
But actually, going into the thing I joked about earlier, though, I want to ask you, though, what it's like living, like being in New York and shooting, and then there are actual like 30-year-olds spying on you. Because what is it like just knowing that like anytime you go to lunch or dinner, like it's gonna pop up on like Demois, like this Instagram account? I just, like, every time I look at it, it's always like they're tracking each of the Gossip Girl cast and like whatever you do. And it's almost just like the teacher stalking you on the show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a funny one the other day on Demois. Someone sent me it, and it was a picture of me in Target because I just got back from filming in Budapest, and I'm just trying to like do up my apartment. So go to Target, it's great. And there was a picture of me with like on a trolley, and it was like, tip, Anon, just saw Thomas Doherty in Target. He looked exhausted. Was struggling to push the car.
Thomas Doherty had his final trip to Target before his untimely death.
No, it's bizarre. I mean, I think it's just kind of a weird place we are right now in the world. I mean, it's, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not even right now in the world. It's happened for decades now, the kind of culture, the pop, the celebrity culture, and people's fascination with it. And I think it's because they don't view actors or people on TV as people. I think because you're very like objectified, you're almost like an object, and maybe that's because of the characters or whatever. And it's really weird because you have this object, but it's also in your living room every week. So it feels intimate at the same time. So people, I feel like, might feel like they have a right to. I don't know. But from my side of things, it's bizarre. But again, you kind of get used to it. And I'm kind of detached from the idea that people have of me, because they're never going to like know who I am if I walk past them in the street or interact with them, or if they've just seen me on TV. That's not me. So I'm kind of detached from the idea that they've projected onto me. So I don't really mind it.
I mean, the thing that always comes to mind for me is when people are at a concert and everybody pulls out their phone. It's like, nobody wants to watch your weird concert footage. Why are you doing this? And it's because people can't pass up an opportunity to have like something that might jump off on social media. Like, they can't pass it up. So it's like, du moi to me is like one of the nastier iterations of that, where it's like, I saw someone do literally anything. I'm sorry, like going to Target is among the most mundane things a human being could do, but that's still like a coin they have.
Yeah.
You know, like they can't pass up having that.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it's like when it's like New Year's and everyone just takes pictures of fireworks and then everyone posts fireworks. And I'm like, I don't fucking, I've seen what? Why? I don't care.
And in a way, too, it feels like that is a direct descendant of the original Gossip Girl. I mean, like, Jawad is basically, it's Gossip Girl for the Instagram. And now it's weird where there is a Gossip Girl following people while also you're depicting it.
Very Scream 4. Yes, we're like outside and inside the Gossip Girl. Like, you know, it's an Ouroboros. It's eating itself. Yeah. Yes, right. Yeah.
What do you guys think? What do you guys think about it? Because you guys must have watched it or grown up with the original. What do you guys think?
Ira did. I've only seen the first season. I mean, like, I'm not like a teen kind of melodrama person, much as I actually like the recent film work of Blake Lively.
I like Blake Lively's work, you know, that not that backwards movie, but you know, the
well, by the one with
not the rhythm section either.
That one's iconic. And then can't forget Savages, the Savages. Sorry, Savages is Philip Seymour Hoffman. I watched the original, and the original for me is also. It's a weird place in my life because the original came out in 2007, and that is the first year that I moved to New York after I finished college. So I was living in New York for the entire duration of Gossip Girl. Then I went to NYU for grad school at that point. And the last season actually aired like my first year in LA. So for me, it feels like a time in my life and revisiting it. And like, how does Josh depict it to you? Like, who he sees as the audience for this? Because the original Gossip Girl is for teenagers. It's on the CW. But this one is on HBO Max. And so it is ostensibly for adults who grew up watching Gossip Girl, and then for younger people too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I've not really had that conversation. I guess you just try and stay as truthful to what's written on the page and kind of take it from there. But yeah, that people that do kind of approach you are a lot older. I was expecting a lot of a younger audience, but yeah, I mean, you're talking like late teens, early 20s, mid 20s, which was unusual. I wasn't really expecting that. But I feel like it's a little bit more intense this time around. Like, in terms of what they've seen. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely more intense. Yeah, definitely.
That's a nice way to put it, adult. I'm going to write that down.
What do you think of the new Gossip Girl? Well, it's adult.
Yeah.
I will say that one thing I really love about you in the show is that your character could be, you know, seen as just like a new version of Chuck Bass, but I think that you put a lot of like sort of unexpected emotion and comedy into it. And knowing you in real life, like, you're a very funny person in general, but you're also like a very sweet person too. And I see that coming across in Max on the show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I was so conscious, because I mean, you have such a kind of solid foundation of characters and character dynamics from the original, and it's obviously been brought over to this one. And so you have these like eight lead characters, and then obviously I fall into that kind of the Chuck role of it. So you kind of have to indulge in that a little bit. But I was so conscious to make it like 2021 version of Chuck. Because I mean, he is very, very different, and I wanted to make him a lot lighter, a lot more kind of mysterious and cheeky without being dark. And yeah, I hope I did that.
Okay, well, here's a pressing concern. Have you been approached to play Frank Sinatra yet? Because as I'm sure you've been told throughout your life, it's disturbing that you look this much like Frank Sinatra.
I mean, it's the first time I've ever heard that in my life.
No, you must be absolutely kidding. It's like, I don't know if you know the actor James Darcy, but he always looked to me exactly like Anthony Perkins, and then he got to play Anthony Perkins finally in the movie Hitchcock. So anyway, you're talking about manifestations now. There's no way this isn't going to happen, and I'm worried it hasn't already.
That would be a big truth to film, but no, that'd be really cool.
Well, they're letting Tom Holland play Frank Sinatra, so I think you got a chance.
Tom Holland's playing
Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire.
He's playing Fred Astaire.
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. Well, there we go. Yeah. Okay. I was wrong.
Can he tap dance?
No, you don't. Well, kind of. He did that lip sync battle once where he did Rihanna, and we called it tap dancing, so maybe. He was in Billy Elliot, so he's got some.
Oh, yeah, he was, wasn't he? I forgot about that.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things about Frank Sinatra is that I guess there's this deli that sells bread that like Frank Sinatra used to like. My friend Rob, who's Italian and a writer in New York, told me about it. But it's this place where like when he wasn't living in New York, he would like have it frozen and sent to him like out in Los Angeles or Vegas or wherever he was. So I would love to see you play Frank Sinatra and learn more about Italian bread. I don't know.
this is your chance to learn more about focaccia.
Imagine having that fuck you money. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, to order bread. What would you order from Scotland to remind you of home if you could just like spin whatever you want?
I mean, I'm trying to forget. I'm joking. I can't, honestly, I mean, it's not like Scottish cuisine, but I love Nando's. Have you guys ever heard of Nando's?
I love
like
Nando's.
How is it not made it over to at least New York?
Yeah, it's in DC.
Is it?
They have it in DC.
There's one in Vancouver as well.
I fucking love Nando's. Mm. Have you heard of it, Lewis?
Okay, we need to blue sky this idea. Bring it over.
Nando's is Nando's is like this chicken joint, which is like in the UK. And it's it had 14. Like a big sort of like social media like moment in like 2015, but it's just like it they have this great peri peri chicken sauce, which is like the Nando's sauce, and I just always think about it because if you remember the show Looking, there was a whole plot line on it about creating peri peri chicken and selling it in San Francisco.
Oh.
And it's basically
Nando's. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Got
so.
It.
Mm.
No, wait, before we let you go, do you have a single favorite Scottish celebrity?
Do you?
I tried to Google Scottish celebrities and Google is out of its mind. It just says Scottish people. Ewan McGregor, Craig Ferguson, Gordon Ramsay, Annie Lennox, Nicole Kidman, Courtney Cox, Rob Kardashian, Minnie Driver, Alicia Silverstone. I don't know if I believe this.
I mean, it's a small country, but we're trying.
Well, thank you for being here, Thomas.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. Honestly, I'll finish off my Dunkin' Donuts and head back into the wilderness. All right, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. What a pleasure.
Goodbye.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Well, the year is over, so as is culture podcast law, we're going to do a year in review segment where we're picking our favorite performances of the year.
I feel like Gene Siskel, I feel like Gene Shalit, all the genes of yore.
Gene Parmesan.
Gene Smart, yeah. Gene Arthur. That's an old movie star people could stand to revisit. Gene Arthur is a slay. Look up her work.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll definitely do that right after this podcast wraps. I mean, before we get into our list, I feel like you just mentioned Gene Smart, and I think that everyone would agree that Gene Smart had a year.
Correct. Though I think I would root for, if I had to put Gene Smart on this list, I would put her maybe in Mayor of Easttown over Hacks. I know people like are obsessed with Hacks, and she's great on Hacks. Mayor of Easttown,
I would pick Mayor too.
Way less to do, but just that mom character, somehow one of the very grounding parts of that show. Kate Winslet is one of my top performances that actually was on my list. We can get into her specifically because, man, I don't know what that show would be without that performance. She really is doing a lot with silence in a way that I've not seen on like a TV serial in for a long time. I also didn't know.
And we know that you love that.
She had it in her.
Famously.
Yes.
Famously, Lewis loves a series with a woman thinking.
That's all I want. Is she driving a car and looking out her window, not doing shit? Love it. Something's going on in the noggin. I want to see that. I rooted for Kate Winslet in a villain-like way over Anya Taylor-Joy because some people are too young to win Emmys, and Anya Taylor-Joy is one of them.
Fair.
Zendaya won that Emmy, I'm like, now you have nowhere to go.
Oscar?
But that she's EGOTing too quickly. And then what? Then you're Rita Moreno EGOTing by 45, and then we like don't know what to do with you.
We'll stick her in Porky and Bess. Actually, I think there is a Porgy and Bess playing right now. At any rate, I loved Kate Winslet in that, and I would actually agree that I would put Gene Smart's performance in Mare of Easttown like just slightly above her Hacks performance because I thought it was I don't know, it was something different from Kate Winslet.
Yeah, right. Well, also, Kate Winslet, like the high priestess of bad movie making decisions over the past decade. Look at her filmography. You're like, what the fuck is The Mountain Between Us? What the fuck is Labor Day? What is Men, Women, and Children? Like all the, or one of those I know she's not in. Anyways, dubious. Oh, Wonder Wheel. And then she finally has this moment where she's as good as she was in my favorite Kate Winslet movie, which is Little Children.
I think my favorite,
You're an eternal sunshine queen. I know it.
I am an eternal sunshine girl, you know? Well, at least until Avatar 2 and 3 come out. I'm sure those will be my favorite Kate Winslet movies.
Is she in that?
She's in Avatar.
Oh, my God. Also, I mean, literally, we've been talking about Avatar 2 for something like 7 years now, right? It's becoming that Guns N' Roses album that did eventually come out.
Allegedly, Avatar 2 is supposed to be coming out next Christmas.
I'm so overwhelmed by that. I literally want to throw my head down because you know they're going to push it back.
Mm.
And we'll have the same conversation 1 year from now.
Lewis is going to love who I'm picking first.
Oh, here we go. Hit me.
WandaVision.
Oh, no.
But I'm going with Elizabeth Olsen.
Okay, great. Well, she's wonderful, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, listen, I think that Catherine Hahn is very great in the series, but I do think that there was a bit of an obsession with Catherine Hahn in this series that did not match what the character Agatha delivered.
Okay, yes. Also, I know this is my least favorite term that always pops up on Twitter, gatekeeping. But when the gays fell out for Catherine Hahn, they're like, I'm obsessed with Catherine Hahn. I've always been obsessed with Catherine Hahn. Me with my opera glasses leaning over being like, name three Catherine Hahn movies, go. And they never could. You know why? Because people don't know how to be real fans on Twitter. They just want attention for liking something even for 5 seconds.
Okay. Well, I could say I love Dick.
Of course. No, I'm not saying you don't know shit. I'm talking about everybody else.
Yeah. And Anchorman.
No, I wouldn't say that. That's one of the few movies I've ever seen where I wanted to walk out of it and like and ask for a refund. Like,
you
like
hate
a mean
Anchorman?
Woman with her poodle. Yeah. Oh God. I'm feeling bad for Christina Applegate the whole time. Yeah. Weirdly, something notable about my mom is there was a prompt I saw online recently asking people, what celebrities do your parents irrationally hate? And my mom's disdain for Will Ferrell is so specific and comes up kind of often.
Is it because of like all the somewhat misogynistic jokes in Anchorman?
Well, we definitely did see Wedding Crashers, in which he has an extended cameo, and that ruined my mom's life. Mm. But additionally, I think it's just the loud thing. I feel like my parents come from like an era of like drollness, like watching like, you know, Basil Rathbone-y kind of Sherlock Holmes is like the speed at which they do things. So when you have a guy just hoarsely yelling, that like doesn't do shit for them.
That's fair. I also want to say shout out to Catherine Hahn fans who've been riding with her since Crossing Jordan.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Crossing Jordan. Also, I just saw Catherine Hahn in the Jimmy Kimmel produced live in front of a studio audience where she played Joe Palmachek, the Nancy McKeon character on The Facts of Life. This woman looked exactly like Nancy McKeon, as in Nancy McKeon then. I sat there blown away. I had to do behind the scenes work, and so I got to sit there and clutch my face like the painting The Scream and watch Catherine Hahn bring attitude to the part. She was so funny on it. Actually, everybody was funny.
Yeah.
It was nice to see Jennifer Aniston doing sitcoms again.
Anyway, I fucking love Catherine Hahn. I thought she was great in WandaVision, but I will say that Elizabeth Olsen was so good in it and so just bringing like a new depth to the character of Wanda Maximoff. And I thought that that was, until the ending, where it was just, you know, rock 'em sock 'em robots. I really loved how it made a blueprint for how like Marvel series could, you know, go ahead in the future.
The depths. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, being something different than what we've gotten on film, you know, and presenting that to us.
I've been a fan of her since Martha Marcy May Marlene, which is one of the weird, like very memorably unsettling movies. And also one of my least favorite Sarah Paulson performances. That woman usually does not mess up. I did not love her in that movie.
I actually haven't seen that movie. Too many white women's names in it. Just in the title. I don't want to spend time with a Martha and a Marcy and a Maylene.
it's Marlene. But also there Martha, I think, runs black. Martha Reeves, come on. Martha and the Vandellas.
Okay. Marlene. It's the bad this bad way of spelling Marlena. Like from Days of Our Lives. Marlene. The only person I know named Marlene is the creator of Pretty Little Liars.
Mm.
And she's a terrorist. So who's your next?
That's a show I would. Oh yeah. Okay. But I am going to say, and I brought this up in recent weeks, but I'm going to revisit it now. Ruth Negga in Passing is my favorite movie performance of the year. Have you seen Passing or not?
What'd you call me? I love doing that bit.
Why is it funny to me every time? As if I stood here and shouted it at you. Yeah.
I enjoyed passing.
Oh my God, this performance. So if you don't know the original book, which is from the 20s, Nella Larsen's book, this movie is directed by Rebecca Hall, whose own mother, I think by her own admission, she said passed herself as what, because she was half, she was a singer and she was half, or quarter black, part black. And it's the story of Tessa Thompson's
Quadrum.
Character. Yeah, okay, right. A word I would never say, moving right along. Tessa Thompson's character, who's, you know, a black woman, reuniting with this woman she once knew who is now passing as white in, you know, urbane society. And Ruth's performance is so, it's like very performed, like her, the lilt of her dialogue, the way she like sets her chin as she's talking, everything is very like, on point and presentational, and the artifice is so entrancing in a way that it would have to be if people were going to believe she was, you know, a white woman. But also then immediately tragic too, and you realize that her story is strange, her husband is awful and a particular kind of odious white man, played of course by Alexander Skarsgård, who is here to play the odious white man. She's so good, and now I'm hearing she may not even get an Oscar nomination because this movie is like falling off people's radar. I think it is by far my favorite movie performance of the year so far. I am a little behind. I haven't seen West Side Story. I haven't seen Don't Look Up, which I feel like I'm going to hate, but there's a couple I have yet to see. There's only one other performance I've seen in theaters this year that I thought was thrilling too. And we'll get to that in a second. Ira, is there a movie performance you're particularly obsessed with?
Yes. You know, I have seen West Side Story. I would say that I really liked Ariana DeBose and I really like Mike Feist in it, who plays Riff, because that is a role that is you expect, you know, Anita to be you know, a powerhouse.
Dynamite, yeah.
You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I really do enjoy her and that, but I just like, sorry, you know, to give accolades to a white man, but there's something about this Riff that breathed new life into a character that I've seen on stage for years, that I've seen in the original film, and he just felt so real. He felt so real, and he felt so tragic, and I thought that Mike's singing was beautiful. I think that this version of Cool, you know, between him and Ansel is much more powerful than the Cool that was in the original film. It's just a really, really surprising performance from a character that it just always sort of been there and not one of the most important
not
West
a showcase.
Characters. Yeah.
Right,
it was a fucking showcase. And yeah, he was amazing.
What I have seen, though, is Being the Ricardos. Guys, I mean, I'm sure I've had a specific keep it to Nicole Kidman as Lucille Ball in the past, even though I am in no way at all a Nicole Kidman doubter. I thought in this movie she fucking slayed. And now I will be mad if someone like Kristen Stewart takes the top prize at the Oscars, because Nicole Kidman brought the hard-edged businesswoman Lucy to the proceedings. And I think what the movie does really well, because there are, I'm not a Sorkin person. I feel like almost all of his famous movie monologues feel like large print Facebook memes that like your uncles pass around about how like society's falling apart. I usually
Well, my
hate
favorite
it.
Aaron Sorkin monologue is his defense of Jeremy Strong. That he forced Jessica Chastain to post because he's not on Twitter.
Okay, we got to get into that in a second. But Nicole Kidman in this movie, in addition to Javier Bardem and who plays Desi Arnaz and Nina Arianda as Vivian Vance and J.K. Simmons as William Frawley, they're all. What I love about this movie is the believability of how they are hardened showbiz vets. I feel like people, they're familiar icons on they're familiar television icons, but what they, I just thought the depth of their experience and their ability to rely on each other and their ability to be pissed off and knowing each other's professionalism and disappointed in each other's professionalism was so well realized. But we got to get into this Aaron Sorkin thing really quickly, because so Jessica Chastain posted on her Twitter a missive from Aaron Sorkin talking about how that famous Jeremy Strong profile that we talked about last week by Michael Shulman was quote unquote one-sided. Meanwhile, it's a profile. I don't know how many sides you're supposed to give something like that. Aaron Sorkin in this letter showed all of the email responses he gave to the author of the article. And I guess the point was he said nice things about Jeremy Strong, but to me looking at it, it was like, oh, you're saying the writer used your quotes fairly. Like it was supposed to be shady towards the journalist. Meanwhile, I'm so happy we got a long profile that wasn't entirely glowing of a well-known TV celebrity that like sort of let the reader decide for himself what to think. I guess it's a little snarky, but again, what's wrong with that? I don't know. And now people watched Jeremy Strong on Succession last week and are like, whatever process he needs to do, I hope he keeps doing it. He was amazing.
I'm absolutely shocked that the creator of The Newsroom doesn't know anything about journalism.
Oh my God. And a clip from that show was circulating last week. The one where they're on the plane and they find out Osama bin Laden died. Oh my God. If you don't know this clip, continue not to know it.
Maybe the worst thing I've ever seen on television. And I kept watching Power Rangers into Dino Force.
Wow, I love how that's top of mind for you. Immediately, you knew what show was the worst.
I have another movie performance.
Okay.
And that is my queen, Penelope Cruz, in Parallel Mothers.
I have not seen this shit yet. And I, as a rational human being, of course, stand Penelope Cruz.
Yeah. And, you know, I love Pedro Almodovar is, I think, probably my favorite film director. And Penelope is so fucking good. I mean, she's like one of his like muses at this point. And I love the fact that, you know, Penelope decided that like she was done making flop American movies and was like, I'm just going to go make shit in my own language.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah,
some you're of the right. Best performances of her career. Like this is really, really fucking good here. And it's just there's so much subtlety in her face in this film. Because, you know, like, Almodovar comes from that school of cinema, you know, inspired by, you know, like, Cirque and the classic melodramas. And it's all about, like, a close-up on the face, you know, and, like, showing how someone's reacting to something. Yeah, and there's so much of that here. Like, there's one scene, particularly, where she is in bed with one of the other characters, and it's just she doesn't really speak in the scene. Like, she reacts with her face the entire time, and it's moving.
Oh, I'm so psyched to see it. I'm still, something I'm not over with Penelope Cruz is during her Oscar speech for Vicky Cristina Barcelona, so that would have been in 2009, for a 2008 film. She, in her speech, specifically thanks Pedro, who, of course, has nothing to do with that movie. And she says, thank you for taking me on your adventures. That's so sweet. I can't get over how specific and telling that is about their relationship. That basically he's intertwined with the reason she makes films, period.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, shout out to winning for a Woody Allen film, but then using that opportunity to thank Pedro Almodovar.
Yeah, right. Cleverly done.
Mm-hmm. I also love that she and, like, Antonio, like, once presented him with his Oscar, one of the times he won. And I just love looking back on old clips like that, because it just reminds you of how, like, the Oscars, I miss the Oscars, actually. I feel like you now. I love how they'll try to, like, anticipate, like, a moment, you know? Like,
yeah, right.
Like, Penelope and Antonio presenting the award for best foreign language film in the hopes that it was Pedro who won.
Right,
then when he does, they're so fucking excited for him. Like, that's what I love about the Oscars.
That's it's like when Martin Scorsese finally won the Best Director Oscar, and, like, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg got to present it. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, I miss the Oscars. Bring back cinema.
I because the Golden
Globes,
back, so.
The Golden Globes are going to be in a basement somewhere.
When those nominations came out, I, like, forgot that they were still allowed to exist. I felt like I was reading, like, banned literature.
We haven't even bothered to talk about the Golden Globe nominations because I'm like, all right, I'll find out who won it in a tweet.
Yeah, right. They're gonna print them out on, like, a Denny's placemat or something.
Okay, I did tell you that there was a commercial coming.
Oh my god.
And I don't know if you saw the commercial from the post office in Norway.
No. And I have to be honest, rarely do I think about that.
Okay. There is a commercial. It's basically a 4-minute video, and it's called When Harry Met Santa. And it's basically like this gay man who like doesn't have a partner. And it's told over, like, several Christmases in the 4 minutes. It's like Santa, like, he accidentally catches Santa one year while Santa's delivering a gift. And then Santa comes back in each year, and they sort of, like, have conversations and laugh with each other and, like, play board games and shit.
Wow, this is, like, same time next year. Ellen Burstyn, 1978. Go ahead.
But then he's, like, really sad, you know, because he can't spend that much time with Santa. Because he has presents to deliver. Right. And then 1 year, not to spoil it, but it's like 1 year, Santa hires the post office to deliver presents so that he can spend more time with
him.
Oh
my gosh.
And they actually kiss. And when I tell you this,
what is wrong
when
with
I
you?
Tell you this commercial made me sob. It made me sob. It's beautiful. I would love to see it as a full feature-length film, to be honest. And it's
like Zola too.
It's also beautiful because it's for Post and Norge. I've pronounced that incorrectly, probably, but that is the post office in Norway. It was also in celebration of the fact that it was the 50th anniversary since Norway decriminalized homosexuality.
Wow. All right. I mean, that's better than the shit we've got going here.
It is gorgeous. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous commercial, and it made me sob. And honestly, two of the best things I've seen this year are commercials.
What's the other thing?
I think you know what the other one is.
A commercial?
Heartbreak feels good in a place like this.
A place like this. Oh, my gosh.
Nicole Kidman and being the Ricardos? No, Nicole Kidman in the AMC Movies commercial.
Okay, the underrated thing about that, not only so Nicole Kidman has her big speech she gives in her gray JCPenney pinstripes about how the movies mean everything to her. Fine enough. The craziest thing about that commercial is she walks up to the theater and flips off a hood. Like, what? She's like Master Shredder. It makes no sense.
And she's sitting in the theater by herself, which is actually very realistic because when I went to see my friend Drew and I went to see Let There Be Carnage, and it was not even, it was the second to last showing at like the AMC at the Grove. When mm-hmm. we walked out of the AMC, there was not a single employee anywhere.
Oh, I love that feeling of we've abandoned you. Whatever. don't like rob us. Please
break.
Leave.
They take yeah. their break until we're done.
Yeah.
But that has really become like a moment online. And like, I love that I get to see it before every fucking movie now.
No, it's just amazing watching her be entranced by the film Wonder Woman or Creed. Like, she's looking up at the screen like God has appeared on Earth.
Jurassic World 2 is one of them.
Imagine her watching that.
Well, I always think about something like that, and then I remember that celebrities, you know, do have kids. And so then I right. sometimes think about the fact that, like, people who have kids have watched some of the dumbest movies ever. You know, it's like Nicole Kidman could probably be like, I've seen A Shark's Tale 20 times just because a right. child like wants to watch it, you know?
Right. If Sunday Rose has shitty taste, I'm not going to recover from that, though. So I need to see Nicole Kidman watching whatever Power of the Dog or something more fitting for her.
My parents got to see me watch Jingle All the Way every day. Outside of Christmas, I would watch that movie every day for like a year and a half.
I just want to be clear that Jingle All the Way came out when we were like 12 years old. So something is the matter with you.
It's a good film.
Okay, I knew there was something, and it's you. and what's up is your brain. Yeah.
All right, well, we're back. Keep it. And we're back for our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, it's just us.
All right. Short and sweet, or maybe even longer than usual. Who's to say?
Why don't we go with yours? Because I feel like it's something that's going to... I already know what your Keep It is, and I know it's going to drive me crazy. So.
Okay, good. Well, we'll start there. My Keep It is to all Christmas music made after 1980. Let me explain. Now, obviously, it's Mariah season. I think she's number two on Billboard again with All I Want for Christmas Is You. That's fine. I need to hear something when I walk into Rite Aid. And if it's that, great. I can get into a little Whitney Houston, Do You Hear What I Hear? There are a few exceptions to this rule, I guess.
Last Christmas by Wham is 1984.
I literally don't want to hear it. I'll tell you what Christmas music needs for me. A little bit of darkness. I need to hear the Bing Crosby, like, bourbon-y quality, the melancholy, the rocky relationship with your kids. I need to hear people who, in their low register, sound like a vampire. So this can be anywhere from Bing Crosby, actually, to Frank Sinatra, to Karen Carpenter is maybe the last of these people, where there's something, and this is and this is a word I hate using in reference to music. It's so overused. Haunting about them. Christmas music has to transport you to the past. It has to transport me to, like, you know, a kinder, gentler America, which brings me to my next point. Christmas is a little MAGA. It's a little bit about, didn't things used to be better once upon a time when we were all nice to each other? And it just means, you know, white people. I really enjoy just the timelessness of someone like Perry Como, someone like Nat King Cole, you know, people who have that quality that's both sweet and bone chilling in the clarity of their voice. And I feel like we just don't have singers like that anymore. Like, I think of someone like Michael Bublé, who's the resident new Christmas singer, and he has the soul of Flat Stanley. So it just doesn't play the way I want it to.
Okay, you know, I will agree. Okay. I will agree that I love throwback Christmas music. I mean, I could put on A Christmas Gift for You from Phil Spector anytime.
Mm.
You know?
Yes.
I love, you know, like, Elvis actually even has a good Christmas album.
Yes. I will say this. Elvis, a good singer in this genre, though, something about Elvis in particular always sounds a little bit like he's kidding. Like, that's really your voice? That's really what, like, that's okay. That's your instrument. All right.
Mm-hmm. The Beach Boys have a good Christmas album too.
Oh, fuck yes. I love the Beach Boys. I love Beach Boys Christmas music.
I weirdly haven't been listening to that much Christmas music this year, and I'm usually a person who turns it on before Thanksgiving.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've had to remind myself to do it because in LA, you have to remind yourself it's Christmas. It looks, you outside right now, it could be March 24th, you know?
And I didn't do a tree this year because I'm going to be gone for Christmas. So
I never decorate for Christmas. It's too much work.
Yeah, I did it last year. It was like my very first like Christmas tree, you know, like as an adult. My roommate and I decorated it, put like getting all the ornaments and then getting the lights and then putting things together. And then like the shedding that happened from the tree. I was like, what the fuck do we do this shit? I'm not doing that ever again.
No, especially if there's no kids involved or whatever. I just feel like all gay, specifically with gay men, whatever. If you own a house and you're going to throw a party, okay, great. Like, I'll contribute to your fund to decorate the house, but it's not going to be mine.
All right.
Ira, what is your keep it?
My keep it this week goes to Time Magazine.
Oh. That's where Time Magazine is where I go to stay up to date on all the latest Claritin ads.
Time Magazine named Elon Musk their person of the year. And people are upset about it. And I'm upset only because I can't believe that we still care about who Time's person of the year is.
That's a good take. I agree.
You know, yeah. It's there's nothing like Time doing their person of the year. Like, I think when they made it Trump 1 year too, there's nothing people love doing more than these long threads about like the essential workers or like the cop who, you know, defended the Capitol during the insurrection, or like Amazon workers. Like, people love to soapbox in response to the Time person of the year by pointing out people who should actually be highlighted. And I'm like, that's great. But it's also stupid, you know?
It's also like, not the point. Like, Hitler has been person of the year. And, you know, it's rare that they pick like someone who is purely virtuous as, you know, person of the year.
Yeah, because it's never about, it's never about virtuosity. It's about, you know, it's about how much that person mattered in the year, just in terms of like the discourse, you know? And I actually don't know if I would have picked Elon Musk because I didn't find him to be that incredibly important in any discourse this year.
No, right.
But it is, once again, a magazine, you know, like knowing that like people are going to talk about Elon Musk, that people are going to drag him online. And it's just giving more attention and traction to Elon being person of the year. And it's just going to reward Time making decisions like that each year.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, usually they just give it to whoever was elected president, you know, like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris got it last year. I hate Time person of the year when they pick cute answers. For instance, when they're like, you are the person of the year, or the computer. It's like, not a person. I don't know what the statement is here now that you're deciding that a computer can compete in this pageant. I wish they would stick to their guns and just pick, you know, there's some really weird choices in the past. Wallace Simpson, the year of the Edward VIII situation in the 30s. I think Angela Merkel, was she the person of the year? I don't know. So it's a strange and winding pantheon.
Mm-hmm. Charles Lindbergh was man of the year.
Also known as Charles Lindbergh.
Oh. was it the Lindbergh baby?
Nope, Lindbergh. It's his baby.
Oh, it's been Lindbergh the whole time?
Yeah, girl.
Well, maybe that's why I haven't been able to find that baby.
Your Google search has been all wrong. Yeah.
I might have seen the baby.
Your detective skills?
I might have seen the baby and called it Lindenberg. And the baby was like, that's not my name. And kept walking. Who would you?
Biopic we need. Ira bungling the Lindbergh baby case.
Who would you have named your person of the year?
Oh, gosh. Maybe Fauci. Kind of basic. I'm sure he's in there like runner-ups pageant or whatever.
Yeah. Greta was in 2019. Remember her?
Right, yes.
Is she in school or something? Is she away at college? I haven't heard from Ms. Thunberg in a minute.
She's in detention right now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They didn't release a short list this year, by the way. So we don't know who the other people possibly in the running would have been.
Oh, so it could be Aida. When is she coming back to Keep It, they're wondering.
Well, Lewis, she's back January 4th.
Many listeners are confused and think she is lost to time or we've banned her from the studio or something. And to be honest, when she does tweet the one thing that sets us off, we can't be held responsible for what occurs. But she is still on the show and she will be back January 4th.
This is just like one of the weirder conspiracy theories I've seen online, only because it's very clear from her Instagram that she is in Miami shooting a television show.
The clues are there. And you, as a detective for now 100 years,
no. But yeah, she'll be back when we kick off season 5 of Keep.
Can you believe we've been doing this for we started in 2018, so it's 4 years since we started, but it's our 5th year. Jesus, we're like the Big Bang motherfucking theory up in here.
I would love it if this show were just like the Big Bang Theory.
I would not. I don't know why you would say that.
Bazinga.
I do want more catchphrases. I do think I should have one. I guess sometimes I say moving on. That's my catchphrase.
You say moving on. You say...
guileless. I say that a lot.
Guileless. You do say guileless a lot. Yeah. So... Mm-hmm. No, let's come up with a catchphrase for you next year.
Okay, good. We'll put some on the whiteboard and maybe put it to a vote. Who knows?
Keep It was the last catchphrase I ever came up with. And I don't want to do it again. How did Bart Simpson do it so much?
I know, right?
Anyway, have a good end of year, everybody. Thanks for listening to Keep It for 4 years.
Jesus Christ. Sorry for what we've put you through and that you keep coming back for more. In a way, it's on you.
And I'm sure we've got plenty more surprises in store for next year. I love when people say something like that. I don't know.
Like we're the Gong Show. You have no idea who's coming out next.
It'll be the same damn show you've been listening to. We'll see you on January 4th.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. But I, Louis Fertel, do a good job too. Our audio engineers are Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin, and the show is mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.